What the Democrats have been doing, in my judgment, is focusing on the wrong initiative, and that is more funding cuts, more timetables. What I would propose is a deauthorization resolution under the War Powers Act, Article 1, that basically allows the Congress to determine whether we're at war or not.
Democratic presidential hopeful Bill Richardson on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. And as members of Congress returned from their Memorial Day break, what kinds of earfuls did they get from constituents on the war funding and immigration bills? The politics of this, both of these things getting even more interesting. Some things happened just going into the Memorial Day weekend that probably some of the members and some of the presidential candidates hope would get a little bit hidden and forgotten by the holiday. But here we are Tuesday morning, and we're going to talk about some of those things. Let me play another clip first. Also on the presidential campaign trail, we heard Bill Richardson there. John McCain is proving himself to be probably the most comfortable with taking talk show style sarcastic swipes at his opponent. No diplomacy here as he goes after Romney the other day after Romney decided to oppose the immigration bill for its being too pro-amnesty, in his opinion.
In the case of Governor Romney, you know, maybe I should wait a couple of weeks and see if it changes, because it's changed in less than a year from his position before. And maybe his solution will be to get out his small varmint gun and drive those Guatemalans off his lawn.
So McCain is referencing Romney's various flip-flops and extensions of the truth, like about his hunting record there, the small varmint gun. And I gather that Romney supported last year's version of the Kennedy-McCain immigration bill, which was actually more liberal than this new one. So McCain and Romney going after each other. I'll read some transcript of McCain and Obama going after each other in a few minutes. But let me open up the phones right now for likely voters in the Democratic presidential primaries, whenever they are, probably February 5th in your state, if you're anywhere in our listening area. This war funding bill that gave the president the money to continue to fight the war through the end of September, and with no timetables, as was in the original bill, Senator Clinton and Senator Obama both voted no on this bill. They were probably reacting to John Edwards, who has said Congress, if they have any guts, should send the president the same bill over and over again that has the funding but also has the timetables for withdrawal. So perhaps feeling the pressure from the Edwards campaign, Obama and Clinton both voted no on this war funding bill, even though they have both said that they would not let the troops go wanting. So, in your opinion, Democrats, did Clinton and Obama do the right thing? 212-433-WNYC. In fact, we'll open this to anyone. 212-433-9692. Independence, does this make you think any more well or less well of Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama? Were they standing on principle? This, of course, was the Democratic deal, right? Nancy Pelosi helped strike the deal. She also voted no, saying that on the one hand, she had an institutional responsibility to do this. On the other, this goes against what she, as an individual member of Congress, believes. So did Nancy Pelosi do the right thing? Do you understand the message? Do you understand the message that Clinton and Obama are trying to send by saying they will never let the troops go wanting for material support while they're in the field, but at the same time voting no on this interim troop funding bill? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And here is an Obama supporter first, Michael in Manhattan. Hi, Michael. You're on WNYC.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I think that that both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are, although I agree with their decision to vote no to send funding, I believe that they're trying to straddle two sides of a position. You can't say that all we want to give the soldiers everything they need and then at the same time not vote for funding.
So if Obama is trying to run as a new kind of politician, more of a straight talker, for example. Does this make you think less of him?
I think those days are becoming more over. The closer we get to the election, the less of a new candidate he will be, because it's all about 30-second sound bites. John Edwards has been going down in the polls since his haircut fiasco, and that's all people tend to think about. So, yes, I think that eventually he's just marching to the beat of someone else's drum.
Okay.
It'll be John Edwards right now.
Michael, thank you very much. And Selma in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Selma.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a Democrat, and I will never vote. The last Republican I ever voted for was Jacob Javits. I will never vote Republican again. Anyway, be that as it may, I'm glad that Hillary and Obama and I think Chris Dodd also voted no, too.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, so those three. I'm glad they voted no. However, I think the best strategy would have been John Edwards' suggestion to just keep on sending him the bill repeatedly.
Right. So in lieu of that, which the leaders of Congress weren't going to take up, then you would just as soon have them vote no. And what about the perception, Selma, as someone who will never vote Republican again, the perception that Democrats are willing, these Democrats who are running for president, one of them is going to get the nomination, probably. So if they, you know, were not willing to support the troops in the field with this funding, do you think that leaves them vulnerable in the general election against a Republican? You know the Republicans will say it.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, the Democrats have loud voices, too, or they should have loud voices, and they shouldn't be wimps. You know, I mean, the right thing to do is to get this war over with as soon as possible. Because no matter when, if you're going to stay there forever, no matter when it's over, it's going to be a mess in Iraq.
Selma, thank you very much. Let me get one more in here before we go to our first guest, because Jim in Brooklyn says he's calling as a Democrat and a Chicagoan. What does that mean?
Well, I used to live in Chicago. I'm from Chicago.
Yeah.
And
we have Clinton and Obama. We have two good Chicago area folks there, right?
Right. Right. And I think they did absolutely the right thing. And I couldn't agree more with Selma, the last caller, that I also, in a similar, I voted for Jim Thompson the first time and will never vote Republican again.
All right. But let me read you now this exchange between Obama and McCain over the weekend. McCain still, you know, he's standing out there. He's flying against the Republican base on some things and flying against the Democrats on some other things. And this is from the Daily News version on Saturday morning. It says the contentious vote also sparked a spirited clash between Obama and Senator John McCain, who traded increasingly personal jabs over the issue throughout Friday. McCain said Clinton and Obama were, quote, waving a white flag to Al-Qaeda, unquote, with their votes. Then Obama shot back in a written statement, dredging up McCain's most embarrassing recent moment to say the Arizona senator is mistaken to believe the war is working. Here's a quote from the Obama statement. If there was ever a reflection of that, it's the fact that Senator McCain required a flak jacket, 10 armored Humvees, 2 Apache attack helicopters, and 100 soldiers with rifles by his side to stroll through a market in Baghdad just a few weeks ago, unquote. An hour later, McCain hit back with this statement: Obama's 2 years in the U.S. Senate certainly entitle him to vote against funding our troops. How's that for snarky? Using his 2 years in the U.S. Senate in a sarcastic way and then voting against our troops. By the way, Senator Obama, it's a flak, F-L-A-K jacket, not a flak, F-L-A-C-K jacket, McCain added, as it was misspelled in Obama's statement. And he says Obama wouldn't know the difference between an RPG and a bong. So there they go. But imagine the McCain-Obama matchup where, you know, McCain is saying Obama voted no on this bill, voted to surrender to Al-Qaeda.
Okay, well, if you're against the war, if you want an end to it, you have to take the steps that need to be taken. What the Democrats have been getting criticism about recently has been that they're not willing to cut off the funding because they're not standing up for their principles by cutting off the funding.
They'll take it from one side or the other, depending on what they do. Jim, thank you very much. And my first guest today to talk more about these issues and others is the author and former New Yorker Washington columnist Elizabeth Drew. She has a new biography of Richard Nixon in the Times Books American Presidents series. It's called Richard M. Nixon. She did cover Watergate, among other things, in the Nixon era. And Elizabeth, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. It's always nice to be talking to you.
And I mentioned before the news the T-shirt that one of my producers saw at an East Village street fair over the Memorial Day weekend that said, "I never thought I'd miss Nixon." Are you surprised such a T-shirt exists?
No, I'm not. There is a fashion now, actually, to say, among many people, to say, oh, if only we could have Nixon back. They go on to say he was so good and progressive, even liberal, on domestic policy. Well, that's a bit of a myth. The nostalgia for Nixon, I think, arises in some part just sort of out of the mist of fading memory. And I had to, you know, go back and look at him entirely anew.
Didn't he support some kind of negative income tax or something, which would be, you know, a distribution of federal funds to the poor?
Yeah, this is the thing. Is it? I think one of the pieces of nostalgia for Nixon is that Nixon was a very smart man, a truly smart man. This was part of his tragedy. And he had, you know, he had an understanding of the world. He didn't always get it right, as in Vietnam. And I think people just long for someone who, you know, took that subject so seriously. Yes, he did propose a family assistance plan, which changed the welfare program into cash payments for the poor. And it was a pretty radical proposal. The thing is, I found in the diaries of H.R. Perrin, Bob Perrin Haldeman, his top aide, not shortly after Nixon proposed that, he said to Haldeman, "Okay, make sure it doesn't pass. We can't afford it." And
so after, he would propose things or publicly support things that he actually worked against.
Excuse me. Yes, he would. That one in particular.
You need a minute?
No.
I'll tell you what.
In other cases, on the domestic front, he would. A lot of what happened under Nixon and a lot of new domestic programs were enacted. But they were largely in response and reaction to a Democratic Congress.
A more Democratic Congress than we have today. But looking back on some of those things, one that came up just recently, the Clean Air Act passed under Nixon. All the formative environmental laws did. And the Clean Air Act was just interpreted by the Supreme Court as applying to global warming, even though nobody was talking about global warming back around 1970-71, but that the carbon emissions are definable as pollutants under the Clean Air Act. So there was a very progressive piece of legislation for its day that you got to think President Bush would have vetoed.
You have to look at Nixon on domestic policy in his own context, which was very different than the context today. There is no question, as I said, a lot of progressive legislation passed, including the Clean Air Act. That was actually sponsored on Capitol Hill by Senator Muskie, and Nixon tried to reduce the funding for it. He didn't veto, but he would struggle over the funding or impound, that is, just say he wouldn't spend the money. But Nixon governed in the pre-Reagan era. The conservative takeover of the Republican Party did not occur until after his presidency. In many ways, he put it in motion. Nixon always described himself as a pragmatist, and I think he should be taken at his word when you look at what he did do on domestic policy. A Republican senator at the time to me, said, called Nixon the man with the portable center. And I have a quote from George Romney, the father of the current candidate, who was then a cabinet officer, and he said, "I don't know what Nixon believes. I'm not sure he believes in anything." He was dealing in the context of a strong Democratic Congress and a more assertive one than we have today, and in a different era. And he got into the environmental movement. He actually called environmentalists privately to his aides. I'll just use it's a four-letter word that I probably shouldn't use.
Well, you can refer to it.
What?
You can refer to it.
Well, crap for clowns. And the environmental movement was a bunch of clowns. But he had polls taken before his 1970 State of the Union address, and this was when the environmental movement was at its height. Rachel Carson had published Silent Spring.
10 years earlier.
Yes, 10 years earlier, but it was still a big thing. The Cuyahoga River in Cleveland had caught on fire. There had been a major oil spill on the California coast. And Earth Day had already been legislated. That was led by Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin, who was probably the strongest environmentalist of his or any other time.
Elizabeth Drew, my guest on WNYC. She has a new biography of Nixon, but is also following current events in Washington. And before we go to a break and then talk about some other things, let me get your reaction. I think you were on the phone listening as I was reading the transcript of those written exchanges. I don't think either of them went to a microphone, Obama or McCain, because they probably didn't want sound bites or YouTube videos of these words lasting into the ether until a year from now. But, you know, after the war funding vote last week, McCain said that both Obama and Hillary Clinton were, quote, waving a white flag to al-Qaeda, unquote. Then when Obama hit back in a statement about McCain having to wear a flak jacket and all of that stuff when he went to Baghdad, that's how well the war is going. And he spelt flak in, you know, the spelling of a public relations official, F-L-A-C-K, instead of the actual spelling of flak in the military sense, F-L-A-K, for flak jacket. McCain put out another statement saying, "Obama's 2 years in the U.S. Senate certainly entitle him to vote against funding our troops. By the way, Senator Obama, it's a flak jacket, not a flak jacket. Obama wouldn't know the difference between an RPG and a bong." And I thought, well, there's a good Nixon-era reference, a bong. But the is that unusually harsh for presidential candidates at this point from other parties?
Well, this point is a far advanced point, if you follow me. In other words, we're getting into the heavy fighting much earlier than before. The whole timetable has been moved up. You know the old expression, politics ain't beanbag, and the war is the most heated and the most important issue in the campaign. I wouldn't make much of the letter C in flak, because undoubtedly the statement was written by an aide who didn't use the spell check. That doesn't mean that Obama is ignorant about all of these issues. I think this is the kind of thing, it's a preparation for the general election. McCain had already been saying that a vote against this funding would be a vote for surrender. McCain is, as we all know, very invested in this war. And he's, somewhat emotional about it, most of the time, actually. So none of this, I think, is very surprising. I think the thing is to keep the eye on the ball, which is who seems to have the greater grasp of what we should do about Iraq. And I think that story is still unfolding.
That story is still unfolding, and yet I wonder how much you think Clinton and Obama wind up sending confusing signals to the voters when they say on the one hand that they won't do anything to leave the troops unprotected in the field, but then vote no on this interim funding bill, perhaps in response to John Edwards coming at them from their left saying, hey, we should just be sending the president the same bill over and over again, or you and the Congress should, with funding but timetables for withdrawal.
Well, that's very easy for John Edwards to say. He's not in the Senate, and he doesn't really have responsibility for this. At some point, you have to fund the war. I think the, and of course, if you just keep sending the same thing, then I think Bush would greatly have the political advantage over this. I think the Democrats' big mistake, and it still puzzles me, but they do this fairly often, is they let the president and the Republicans establish the terminology for this fight. In other words, they made it funding for the troops. I don't know why the Democrats didn't try to make it giving Bush a blank check to continue the war however he sees fit. That was really what the argument was about. Now, are
giving him the blank check and then just kind of making him look bad if things aren't going well.
Well,
and the Republican hopefuls like McCain by extension?
I think that's what's going to happen anyway. If things aren't going well, the Republicans will be in a lot of trouble, which is what's causing all this restiveness on their part. And when I wrote recently, now I write for the New York Review of Books,
as
you know, and when I wrote recently a piece about Congress in Iraq, it was clear to me, and this was a while ago now, that the Republicans were becoming very restive, and come fall, if there were not progress, either on the ground in Iraq or in terms of a political settlement, they were getting ready to break with Bush. They stuck with him on this round.
Right.
But a lot of them are ready to...
So September is going to be...
Well, somehow it's become September is the end-all, and General Petraeus's report, I think that's an odd way for the government and the Congress to decide policy on the report of a general. And I don't think all of them will. I mean, you know, they can read the newspapers, they can watch television. A lot of them take trips there fairly often, and they come back with very different reports than what the officials are saying. So
right.
I think in the end they'll make their own judgment.
Right, and yet September and whatever the Petraeus report is may give the Republicans an event to hang a new, more anti-war position on the Republicans in Congress. We'll
it
see
may,
about that.
But I was hearing this restiveness before there was any talk of a Petraeus report.
We're going to continue in a minute with Elizabeth Drew, who writes about politics from Washington for the New York Review of Books and has a new biography of Richard Nixon. We'll talk more about Nixon and these presidential candidates, and I'll get Elizabeth's reaction to some numbers that surprised me in the New York Times poll on Friday on the immigration bill. And we'll take more of your phone calls on any of this. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, though at the moment our lines are full. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Hope you had a wonderful weekend and also took some time out to pay homage to our war dead yesterday. Could hardly believe how little that was referenced in most of the media. People calling up other kinds of talk shows, hey, happy Memorial Day. It's so inappropriate. And yet that's about all you hear. Well, this Friday morning, we are having a live event at the New School on the future of the middle class in New York and other American cities, and you are invited. Come join us for free if you would like. We just had one great event last week at the New School on immigration, and now we're going to do another one this Friday morning. Our guests will include the mayors of Washington, D.C., and Atlanta, Georgia, Mayors Fenty and Franklin, two up-and-coming mayors, in addition to New York City Deputy Mayor Dennis Wolcott, Nassau County Executive Thomas Swasey, so we will relate what's going on in the city itself to what's going on in the near suburbs with Thomas Swasey, and other guests as well. That's 8:30 Friday morning at the New School. For information and reservations, call 212-669-3333 or see the events page at WNYC.org. We're talking about issues in D.C., the immigration bill and the war funding bill, primarily with Elizabeth Drew, former New Yorker Washington columnist. She now writes for the New York Review of Books and has a new biography of Richard Nixon in the Times Books American President series on the immigration bill. Elizabeth, Friday's New York Times had a poll that should be stiff medicine for anybody, but certainly stiff medicine for the Lou Dobbs camp that opposes the bill because they say it's amnesty. Now, listen to some of these numbers. On the question, should Americans welcome all immigrants? Wrong question. Do you think that most recent immigrants to the United States contribute to this country, or do most of them cause problems? By 57% to 28%, they said most contribute to this country. Do you think illegal immigrants coming to this country today take jobs away from American citizens, or do they mostly take jobs Americans don't want? 59% said take jobs Americans don't want. Just 30% said take jobs away from American citizens. Should illegal immigrants get a renewable visa if they pay a fine, have a clean record, and pass a background check? This is, you know, this is the path to citizenship provision that the opponents call amnesty. 67% said yes, path to citizenship. Just 27% said no. And finally, what should happen to illegal immigrants who have been in the U.S. for at least 2 years? And again, 62% said they should be allowed to apply for legal status. Just 33% said they should be deported. So, Elizabeth, they asked the same question way after way after way, slightly different wording, and kept coming up with the same answer. Overwhelming support in the United States for this path to citizenship.
The problem is on this issue, Brian, that the people who say, who answered those questions and said, you know, it's okay to let the 12 million stay here and put them on the path to citizenship, these are not the, et cetera. These are not the people in the streets. These are not the people who are writing letters and heatedly phoning into programs. Also, the actual...
And I don't know how many... It didn't break it down by party to say, you know, who are likely Republican primary voters, for example. But I did notice that another one of the questions, which to me is very interesting, was, should America welcome all immigrants, some but not others, or none at all? Now, you would think that some but not others would be, you know, the overwhelming consensus because it's got a little bit of judgment in there for everybody. But some but not others, welcome some immigrants but not others, 48%. Welcome all immigrants, 24%. Welcome no immigrants, also 24%. Now, if there are 24% of Americans who say the United States should welcome no immigrants at all, maybe that's analogous to the 20% who identify themselves as evangelical, you know, political evangelical Christians. And so that's a small percentage, about the same percentage of the population, but with tremendous clout within the party.
Yes, well, I don't know that it's just evangelical Christians from what I have seen.
No, not on this issue. I'm just saying there's another example of a 20-25% minority that has incredible clout politically.
Well, that's it. And these polls don't reflect where the issue is hot and where it is not. And so when you take especially the border states near Mexico, but elsewhere as well. It's turning up in Michigan. It's turning up all over the place. The defining argument against this bill is the stronger, has the strongest voice in this. Further, that path to citizenship or amnesty, as some call it, that you read, that's a very benign version of what is actually in this over 300-page book, bill, rather. They an immigrant has to go back to the place of origin after X years and wait a year and try to come back. They can't necessarily bring their families. Look, immigration is a very tough and very complicated issue.
Well, they don't have to wait a year. In the guest worker program, they do. In the path to citizenship, it could be much shorter than that, as I understand it. But they're on all of this. Maybe the heat really winds up on the Democratic side, because there was already a Senate amendment introduced with respect to this bill last week that was defeated, that would have deleted the entire path to citizenship from the bill. And guess what? That amendment was defeated with the votes of 26 Republican senators. That is to say, 26 out of, 48 Republican senators voted to keep the path to citizenship in the bill. And so
the Republican Party is very divided on this, as is the Democratic Party. This doesn't register itself by political philosophy.
Right. So now listen to Democratic Senator Robert Menendez from New Jersey on ABC This Week here criticizing the bill.
It undermines the very core of family reunification. And in my mind, in the long term, it tears families apart. When did my children, when did my parents, when did my brother and sister not become part of what I've always heard on the floor of the United States Senate about family values? It dramatically cuts at the...
Well, that's the point, you see. Here's Robert Menendez from New Jersey, himself and Hispanic, of course, and talking about a bill co-written by a lot of people, but mainly Ted Kennedy and John Kyle, a conservative from Arizona. Now, John Kyle and John McCain differ on this issue. McCain is much more, shall we use the word, liberal in his views on immigration. A lot of Republicans are very concerned that in taking these tough positions, they're going to lose too many of the Hispanic voters whom they really need in order to win. So this is as complex an issue substantively and politically as I have seen in a very long time.
So now, do you think it's ultimately going to be the Democrats more than the Republicans who will hold the fate of this immigration bill in their hands, that we've seen from these test votes already that without major changes to this bill, the Republicans are going to vote yes?
I think it's
the Democrats who are going to kill it or pass it.
I think you have to have a coalition. And some of these votes last week were by one vote. So it's a very tenuous coalition. Now, we're looking at the Senate. The House is much more, in overall, its attitude toward immigration is much more restrictive. This bill may, in some form, get through the Senate because this coalition holds. I think the outlook for this bill in the House is much dimmer. Brian, if I may, the occasion for my being here is this book. Can I say something about it for just a minute, and then we'll go back to the...
Yeah, and we're going to run out of time. I was going to ask you if there was an illegal immigration debate going on in the Nixon years.
Not of any consequence. We didn't really... In fact, in all of my research, I didn't really come upon that. There may well have been, but it was nothing that was prominent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the thing about this book is, first, I was asked to write it for the American President series.
It's this part of the series that Times Books is doing.
Right.
I know they've had other historians do other presidents.
Right. The idea is a compact book on each president. So mine is 150 pages, and it's Nixon, birth to death. And there have been so many books about Nixon's domestic policy, his foreign policy, Watergate, even after he left office, or his Senate career. This is Nixon. And I felt when I was done that I really had a whole new take on him, and that I was inside his head and I understood him.
What changed for you? Because you covered the Nixon administration, right?
I did indeed, and my first book was about Watergate and impeachment. What changed is, well, first of all, you have more time to, you know, reflect and cool off and look at the record. I learned a lot more, and some aspects of him came out to me more. And I went where the evidence led me. I'm no Nixon hater. In fact, I ended up feeling some real empathy for the man because he was such a tormented figure. But I also ended up really questioning, or I really think this was not a man who should have been in the presidency. He was too tormented. He was a literal paranoid. And Watergate was just not this break-in on June 17th of 1972. It began, it permeated the administration, and it began the first month in February of 1969. After Nixon was sworn in, he told his aides to set up this private investigatory unit within the White House, paid for by outside private contributions, to spy on people. The fact that Nixon looked at opponents, whether they're political opponents or people he believed to be opponents, as enemies. You know, we got used to that at the time, but think about it. A president sitting there saying, he's my enemy, and we will crush him, and using the instruments of government to go after, including the Internal Revenue Service, to go after individuals. It all came to me in a much more a sharper light. If you look back and you know all the more, you put it together, and this was a man who felt that the opposition party should be undermined, destroyed, that it's...
And yet, Elizabeth, we're going to run out of time in a minute, but and yet we hear today how things are much more partisan in Washington than they were at that time.
Yes, that
was... Is it not true?
It is true. And that's a function of many things. It is a very different time. We have more extreme views on both sides. It was a much more centrist Congress, and Nixon was a very pragmatic president. Now we have more extremes. We have the role of the consultants and the blast facts and just a large industry in stirring up opinion on both sides. We've had a breakdown in trust. It is a totally different era.
And
we do not know how Nixon would have governed in this post-Reagan. He was pre-Reagan, post-Reagan, post-rise of the Christian right, period of a war on terrorism.
Post 9/11 and everything. And it is
right.
Hard to bring people from one era into another one.
He certainly believed in strengthening the powers of the president, and you know, to the extent he could. I think he'd have longed to do some of the things that Bush has done, but a lot of what Bush is doing is recouping powers that were removed from the presidency.
That's right, as a result of Nixon's abuses. Elizabeth Drew, author now of Richard M. Nixon in the American President series, published by Times Books, and she writes about current Washington politics and issues for the New York Review of Books. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you, Brian, as always.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute, Spitzer's DNA deal, more sampling of convicts for more aggressive searches for innocence. But how does this DNA stuff work? Stay with us.